you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, we celebrate the series finale of The Good Place. It's been a surprising broadcast network hit over its four seasons and with a rare subject matter, ethics and morality. We'll hear from writer Jen Statsky and show creator Michael Schur.
I wanted to do a show about what's practically speaking, how do you learn how to become a better person?
The response I've gotten is like, thank you for making a show about being good in a time where it feels like a lot of things are bad.
And we'll also talk to Good Place cast member Darcy Carden, who plays the unforgettable character Janet. It's The Frame. We'll be right back.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
The Good Place ends its four-season run tonight, and with it, so does America's weekly lesson in how to be good. The NBC comedy, anchored by co-stars Kristen Bell and Ted Danson, began in 2016 as a show about the afterlife, but in many ways it offers a look into how people should treat each other while they're still alive. There's even the character Chidi, played by William Jackson Harper, who's a philosophy professor sharing ethics lessons. And whether you realize it or not, the Good Place audience is learning alongside the show's characters. Today, we revisit my interview with the creator and showrunner of The Good Place, Mike Schur. He was joined by Jen Statsky, who's a writer and producer on the show. Schur also created Parks and Recreation. Statsky worked with him on that show as well. Before we began talking about how they weave ethics and comedy together, Schur told us about an upcoming trip he was about to take.
I was invited because of the philosophical discussions that take place on The Good Place. I was invited to attend the annual conference of the National Association of Sartre Scholars. This is not a joke, the highest honor I have ever received in my life. I could not be more excited. It's in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And I am at Mary Washington University. I'm flying there in 2 weeks with Todd May, who is a professor at Clemson, who's an advisor for the show, who is actually a Sartre scholar. So when I was invited, I said, that's very flattering. You should ideally invite one person who knows what he's talking about to this. And so I've recommended Todd, which it worked out perfectly because he works on the show and he knows the subject matter. So the two of us are going to attend this annual convention, and it's going to be amazing.
I think it's fair to say that philosophy is more than a Trojan horse in this series, that in many ways, if you know about philosophy and care about philosophy and care about moral arguments, that you can really engage with this show unlike probably any other primetime show. Has that been something that you always intended? Has it been more, has that response been greater than you initially expected?
I don't know what I expected, frankly. It was just always the way the show was that it was baked into the premise. It wasn't like a thing that we were going to kind of dabble in or that was like on the surface. It was the idea here was always this show is about people trying to be better in whatever way that meant to them to be better people. And the sort of lens we were looking through was ethics. You know, I did a lot of research about the afterlife when I was first developing the show, conceptions of the afterlife in different religions, and they were all very interesting, but that doesn't help you be a better person, right? At some level, the concept of heaven or a sort of celestial reward was just, it's just like, if you're a good person, you get this awesome thing. And it wasn't prescriptive. It wasn't like because it was like your life is over and now you just get to hang out in heaven. More or less in every religion, that's what it promises you. So I wanted to do a show about what's practically speaking, how do you learn how to become a better person? And the proper kind of set of books to read are books about ethics, because that's like, hey, if you're in this situation, here's what you should think about and here's how you should act. So it became, that was the show. That's how the show sort of developed.
Jen, I want to ask you, as a writer, let's just say hypothetically, but maybe actually in truth, there's going to be an episode that's going to talk about utilitarianism, the idea that like the best thing to do is what benefits the greatest number of people.
Right.
And you are saying to yourself or the other writers, but we have to make something that's entertaining, that's funny.
Right, right.
How do you negotiate that territory?
Sure, yeah. I think anytime you're crafting an episode of TV, there's so many different parts of it. We talk a lot about like, what's the comedy engine of this episode? Like, what is the funny situation this person is put in? And then you're talking on a broader level about theme. And so, for example, in the trolley problem episode,
this is a thought experiment first introduced by British philosopher Philippa Foot in 1967.
That is something where you're able to tackle head on this utilitarian idea.
You are driving a trolley when the brakes fail, and on the track ahead of you are five workmen that you will run over. Now, you can steer to another track, but on that track is one person you would kill instead of the five. What do you do?
Situational ethics.
Yes.
Like, is one of them an ex-boyfriend? Or that snooty girl from Rite Aid who was always silently judging my purchases? It's like, yeah, Chickie, a Baby Ruth and birth control. I see the irony. Keep a swipe.
You don't know any of the workers.
Okay, well, then that's easy. I switch tracks. Kill one person instead of five.
But what we've always tried to do is, like, be creative about what are the ways that we can put these themes and these ideas and these broader ideas into the episode, but present it in a funny way for the audience.
Jen, could you tell me a little bit about what it means to be kind of schooled in philosophy, to actually have the instructions or books or articles that writers on this show are expected to look at and consider, and how that changes your approach to writing on this series?
Well, as a person who mostly is interested, grew up watching pro wrestling and now watches Keeping Up with the Kardashians a lot, it's incredibly overwhelming. it's been super exciting, honestly. Like, getting to work on a TV show is a huge privilege in its own right. And then we've had one of the coolest parts of this show is that, like Mike mentioned, like, we have philosophers come in and give us lectures on these topics, on the trolley problem, on utilitarianism. And it's amazing. Like, that, I've worked in a bunch of writers' rooms now. I've never had an experience that's like, not only do I get to write a great show I love, it's like being in college again, and I didn't pay attention in college. So it's amazing to get to do it over. So it's been great.
We're talking with Mike Schur and Jen Statsky about their show, The Good Place. We're visiting with them on the lot of NBC Universal. Mike, I want to ask you about Pamela Hieronymi, who is a philosophy professor at UCLA. Mm-hmm. How did you reach out to her? How did she come to work on the show? What was that first contact like?
So I felt very strongly that I was in over my head after doing a bunch of my own reading while developing the show. And I thought, well, it would be really helpful if there were a professor or two who could on whom I could rely for information and for clarity. And so I just poked around on the UCLA website and I found this woman, Pamela Hieronymi, and she had written a number of papers that I thought sounded like they might be relevant to what we were discussing. And I just wrote her an email out of the blue and said, hi, I'm a TV producer. I'm local. Could you ever possibly meet with me? And just, I can ask you a bunch of questions. And she said, sure. And so we made a date to meet for coffee on the West Side in Santa Monica at a certain time. And I, at a Starbucks, and I went to the Starbucks and she didn't show up. And I was like, oh no, did I get this wrong? And I kept checking. I was like, no, this is right. And finally I sent her an email. I was like, I'm sorry, did I get the date wrong? I'm so sorry. And then like after like, I don't know, an hour and a half, she texted me or wrote me back and was like, oh my God, I totally forgot about our meeting. I'm sorry, I'll be right there. And and she came and she was incredibly apologetic. She had been like working or writing or doing something that a philosophy professor does. And we ended up talking for a long time. I asked her a million questions. She gave me a million answers. It was incredibly helpful. She then later, she's been a sort of like check-in person, like Professor May has as well, where when we don't understand something, we will email her. She came in and gave us, she teaches an intro class at UCLA, and her first class is about the trolley problem. And so when we were going to write an episode about it, she came in and essentially gave us her day one intro to philosophy trolley problem class. And she led us through the entire thing. And even though we kind of knew what was coming, it was still super fun, and it became that episode, and we're forever grateful to her.
One of the premises of the show is that if you want to do something good, you sometimes need help doing it. That there's strength in numbers, and that community can be really important in changing how you behave. Was that something that you settled on as an idea early? Was it something you took away from your own readings about philosophy? Because it does seem to be a central tenet of the show.
It's something I personally believed. So I think I was looking for the philosophical ideas that supported my belief, which is a pretty classic move in the history of thought, right? But in this case, Pamela Hieronymi's thesis advisor is a famous philosopher named Tim Scanlon, who taught at Harvard, where she was a graduate student, and he had this book called What We Owe to Each Other, and it takes the position that the sort of way to formulate a society is by sitting down with everyone around you, assuming that you are all appropriately motivated and reasonable people, and figuring out what rules you can agree to that would not be objected to by the other people around you. It's a pretty simple idea, but it really kind of struck a chord with me because, in Pamela's words, she calls it the can't we all just get along philosophy. And it's like, we all need to survive. And the only way we can survive is if we can come up with rules that other people who are reasonably motivated and decent people won't object to. That sort of crystallized for me what I had been feeling about this. And it really sort of then seeped into the show where, like, there's four human beings who were all unwittingly sort of linked together by an evil demon who's trying to torture them. And I thought, boy, it would be cool if we could say, well, that's how they came to know each other. And the way that they're going to survive is by flipping that on its ear and saying, like, the only way we get through this is with each other's help. That seems like a pretty good sort of arc for four people on a TV show. And that's what the show has become.
After a short break, The Frame will be back, and so will Mike Schur and Jen Statsky from The Good Place. So stick around.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and today we're revisiting my conversation with Mike Schur and Jen Statsky on the Universal lot where they produce the NBC comedy The Good Place. The show ends its four-season run tonight on NBC. It began as a series in which four people find themselves in a bizarre afterlife that first seemed like heaven, but was actually a kind of hell. But The Good Place turned out to be about people grappling with what we all struggle with on some level, and that's how to be a better person. Here's Jen Statsky.
I think that the response I've gotten from people who are fans of the show has overwhelmingly, in a very flattering way, and I think Mike gets this too, is like, thank you for making a show about being good in a time where it feels like a lot of things are bad and people are not treating each other well. Like, it's easy to write off and say, hey, it's just a TV show, who cares? But the truth of the matter is what an incredible privilege to be able to make things that get blast into people's homes, and these ideas that you put out into the world are things that they hear and internalize and think about. And so the fact that the show has resulted in people saying, like, it's actually made me think about how I treat people and being a good person and ethics, like, that to me is the most rewarding thing that can come out of it.
And Mike, what about you in terms of, like, the workplace? Because there have been a lot of stories over the last couple of years, but you could have written these stories for decades about the way that people are treated in Hollywood. And it could be people of color, it could be women, it could be people with disabilities, it could be pay equity. There are any number of issues that this town has not been really good about. So when you're thinking about how you're going to apply ethical behavior to the running of your own show, the way you're going to talk to other people, the kinds of people you want to work with, the kinds of people you're going to fire because you don't like the way they behave, do you feel that you're a different producer having thought about these issues in making this series?
I think I'm a different person, and I suppose being a different producer would be part of that. I've become more interested about more aspects of human life and ethics because of the show. I think that would be accurate to say. I would also say that, you know, you said that Hollywood has not treated certain people so well. Let's be clear, Hollywood has treated almost everyone terribly. Hollywood has a shameful and miserable past and, frankly, present about all people of color, all women especially. It's only in the last couple of years that most of the misery that Hollywood as a machine has created has even begun to come to light. And it's disgusting. It's horrible. It makes me feel ashamed to be a part of the industry. I'm thrilled that it's changing, which it is. It's finally being exposed, and it's finally sort of like coming out of how deep and systemic the problems really are. There's a thing that happens in Hollywood because creativity is elusive and it's gossamer and it's sort of, it floats in the air and no one can quite define it or recreate it sometimes. You know, it's, what does it mean to be a movie star? Who, why is this person a movie star? Why is that person not a movie star? How is this, you know, writer capable of writing this amazing thing and then 1 year later, this terrible thing? It's, it all feels very slippery. And as a result, when people sort of show it for whatever reason that they have the ability to be consistently good at what they do, in the past, they've been allowed to get away with anything. And that is how monsters are made. It's when the system of basic human checks and balances breaks down, people get away with anything they want. If they're making enough people enough money, and if they are if they're sort of like just driving forward in this kind of crazy big power machine. And as a result, one of the bad side effects of that is that people have begun to say, or for years and decades have said, well, this part of the creative process, right? This treating people terribly is just like, that's, you just have to accept that as part of the creative process. That's insane. No, you don't. It's, no one should ever treat people terribly for any reason. And certainly it doesn't, there's certainly no moral calculation where you would say like, it's okay to treat people terribly in whatever way that means if you create something good. I mean, that's absurd. What kind of world are we living in if it's okay to be deeply cruel to some people in order to get something like a good like screenplay or something? That's an insane calculation that people made and have stuck to for decades and decades. It's finally changing. You've finally begun to see companies and individuals and people in Hollywood say, we are not going to tolerate terrible behavior in exchange for either successful product or just creatively interesting product. And thank goodness.
Mike, let me ask you this last question. I think what's interesting, and this is totally anecdotal, is that the show is watched by families. How unusual is that for you to have a show where families watch a show that's hitting people at very different levels based on their age, their education, and where they are in life?
That anecdote of like, I watch it with my family has been said to me about Parks and Recreation. It's been said about Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It was said about The Office, which I did not create or adapt. That was Greg Daniels, but I wrote on that show. And I think that if there's a sort of unifying idea behind all those shows, it's that, first of all, they're on NBC, and so there's less, you know, cursing and nudity and stuff, and parents feel like it's a little bit safer, even if some of the humor is a little bit more adult, but it's not so adult that you have to worry. But I think that those shows are ensemble shows. They have a large number of characters who represent a large number of viewpoints on the world. And there is some kind of unifying theme there that I learned from Greg, which is that your life is your relationships with other people. At some fundamental level, that is what makes your days pass. It is your sort of bonds with other people that matters in the world. And so I would guess, and this, I'm not a psychologist, but I would guess that if there's a reason that families gather to watch those shows, that has something to do with it.
Mike and Jen, thanks so much for letting us come visit.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Up next on The Frame, one of the stars of The Good Place revisits a very special episode.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm LAist correspondent Frank Stoltz. With democracy at a crossroads, my job is to cover civics and democracy from the voters' perspective. I examine who holds power, how they wield it, and how that affects all of us across Southern California.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today we're marking the end of the popular NBC series, The Good Place. When it debuted on NBC, Darcy Carden quickly became a fan favorite as Janet, the all-knowing Siri of the afterlife, who has a human-like body. In the third season of the show, Carden wowed audiences and critics by playing not only two different versions of her own character, but also all four of her castmates in a single episode. While audiences might have fallen in love with Carden overnight, she studied improv comedy for more than a decade at the Upright Citizens Brigade, better known as UCB. When I sat down with Carden, she told me about landing her role in The Good Place.
There was nothing, no information out about this show when I auditioned for it. All I knew is Mike Schur was writing it, Ted Danson was cast in it, and Kristen Bell was cast in it. And that's really all I knew. And I got some weird audition sides.
Sides being a couple of pages from the show.
Yeah. And didn't know they were dummy sides, which means they weren't actually what was going to be in the show. I was like a helpful customer service rep that was helping someone on the phone. And I didn't find out that those were fake until I got the job. And then the day after I got the job, Mike called me into his office like I was like a bad student. He called me to his office and sort of explained what some of the show would look like and what my character was. And that's when he sort of said, Janet is basically like a walking, talking Siri, like an Alexa with a body.
And one of the challenges of a part like that is that acting is typically reacting to the way that other people are behaving. And yet your character, let's just say, has a limited ability to react.
Right.
And that fundamentally is a challenge as an actor. So how do you get there, and how do you work with Mike and the other people who are writing and directing on the show to get to a performance that doesn't feel robotic?
That's a great question. And that was my huge question when we started, which was, as an actor, I'm so programmed to react. That's like as important as any other skill we have as actors is reacting to what your fellow scene partner gives you. And it felt very like sort of stifling. It felt like I had to be aware of my face and my it was hard. I just had to sort of figure out what her what her version of reacting was. And a lot of that is like a sort of weird smile. And I've sort of had to figure out like what Janet's version of a human brain would do. I mean, it doesn't make a ton of sense, but it does to me.
We're talking with Darcy Carden about her acting work on The Good Place. There's an episode that everybody's talking about called Janet's, and you get to play not one, not two, not three, but four of your castmates. I want to play a little bit from this episode.
Just because you don't remember doing something doesn't mean you didn't do it. I have no idea how it happened, but there is definitely a tattoo on my butt that says Jason. That brings us to Derek Parfit.
It does?
Parfit said, even if I have memories from an earlier time, that doesn't necessarily mean it was me. After all, if my brain was split in two and each half was put in a different person, which one is me? All I know is that other Chidi doesn't exist anymore, and this one does. So this must be the real Chidi. And all I know is that you're just barfing Wikipedia all over everyone to avoid talking about your feelings.
Oh my gosh.
When you get a script like that, yeah. I can imagine a variety of reactions. What was yours, and how did you go from what you were reading, yeah. and I suspect you read it before your castmates got yeah. it, to what you actually did when you shot it?
It was funny. I was so flattered and honored, and Mike told me about it a few months before we did it. So I was ready. I knew it was coming. But the whole time that I knew it was coming, I felt like split between being so excited and so honored and really hoping that they decided not to do that episode. The idea was so exciting, but I just thought like, it's not even the work. I mean, I love like the idea of having to dive into all that stuff was exciting to me, but I just, it was a lot of pressure to deliver something that the writers and Mike, they were very excited about. And that felt like you almost forgetting that it's like going to be on TV for the world to see. It's so much about your cast and crew.
Well, it's not just for the world to see. It's for the actors that you're opposite, right, where you are imitating maybe behaviors that they don't recognize that they're doing. So in order to do it justice, do you actually look for specific things that maybe the actors don't notice they're doing? And is that uncomfortable even on a friendly level?
I think, the thing that was that I feared would be uncomfortable, which came true, is I didn't want to do them in front of them. But we did do one rehearsal where they were there. And oof, it was just like, it gives me the chills just to think about it. It was just like, you know, felt embarrassing to do Jamila's British accent in front of her, or, you know, any of their little weird quirks in front of them. But I have an amazing cast of incredible people, incredible actors, and they were so excited for me and excited for the story. So they were very willing to kind of give me whatever I needed. And if that was for them to be there, great. And if that was to go away, which is what I asked them to do, go far, far away, then they did that.
So even though this is obviously tightly scripted, and what you're doing in this episode has to be, you know, kind of blocked very carefully in terms of where you're moving and how you're looking, because there's a lot of digital work that has to be done about how you get multiple versions of yourself. Did you find that all of your improv training was actually really useful, even though it doesn't seem like a scene or an episode where improv is even relevant?
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's so much more to improv than just like coming up with words on the top of your head. It's like, it's also diving into characters really easily and finding small truths about characters and small things that differentiate them from a different character you played. And I think maybe because, you know, it's just like my life and the way it's what I've been doing for so long, I almost forget that that's such a big part of improv, is the quick changing and the having to play believable, grounded characters, funny or not. You know, they have to be believable. Otherwise, what are we watching? You know, so I definitely think that a lot of my improv training helped with that particular episode. You know, and kind of everything I do, every acting job I've had.
Darcy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The 90-minute series finale of The Good Place airs tonight at 8:30 on NBC. And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moan Broadcast Center.
But I know it won't be long.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals: Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.